This problem-seeking mindset is a shortcoming of the writer in each of us. Psychologists who have studied this phenomenon, our predilection for the negative, have reached some fascinating conclusions. As an illustration of what they found, take a look at the following words from a Learn English at Home website. They're all words for emotions. We've excerpted the first 24 of them from an alphabetical list. See if you notice any patterns. Angry, annoyed, appalled, apprehensive, delighted, disappointed, ecstatic, excited, ashamed, bewildered, betrayed, confused, confident, cheated, cross, depressed, emotional, envious, embarrassed, furious, frightened, great, happy, horrified. Those are 24 of the most common emotion words in English, and only 6 of them are positive. In a more exhaustive study, a psychologist analyzed 558 emotion words, every one that he could find in the English language, and found that 62% of them were negative versus 38% positive. That's a pretty shocking discrepancy. According to an old urban legend, Eskimos have 100 different words for snow. Well, it turns out that negative emotions are our snow. This negative focus is not confined to emotions. Across the board, we seem wired to focus on the negative. A group of psychologists reviewed over 200 articles and concluded that, for a wide range of human behavior and perception, a general principle holds true. Bad is stronger than good. Exhibit A. People who were shown photos of bad and good events spent longer viewing the bad ones. Exhibit B. When people learn bad stuff about someone else, it's stickier than good stuff. People pay closer attention to the bad stuff, reflect on it more, remember it longer, and weigh it more heavily in assessing the person overall. This pattern is so robust that researchers who study how we perceive one another have a label for it. Positive-negative asymmetry. Exhibit C. A researcher reviewed 17 studies about how people interpret and explain events in their lives. For example, how sports fans interpret sporting events, or how students describe their days in their journals. Across multiple domains, work and politics and sports and personal life, people were more likely to spontaneously bring up and attempt to explain negative events than positive ones. We could present plenty more exhibits, but for now we'll give you the study's authors the last disappointed word on the subject. When we began this review, we anticipated finding some exceptions that would demarcate the limits of the phenomenon, but we were unable to locate any significant spheres in which good was consistently stronger than bad. Bad is stronger than good. As Leslie Fielder once said, lots of novelists have achieved their fame by focusing on marital problems, but there's never been a successful novel about a happy marriage. 9. A particular strain of this bad is stronger than good bias is critical when it comes to tackling change. Let's call it a problem focus. To see this, consider this situation. Your child comes home one day with her report card. She got 1 A, 4 Bs, and 1 F. Where will you spend your time as a parent? This hypothetical comes from author Marcus Buckingham, who says that nearly all parents will tend to fixate on the F. It's easy to empathize with them. Something seems broken. We should fix it. Let's get her a tutor. Or maybe she should be punished. She's grounded until that grade recovers. It is the rare parent who would say instead, "Honey, you made an A in this one class. You must really have a strength in this subject. How can we build on that?" Buckingham has a fine series of books on making the most of your strengths rather than obsessing about your weaknesses. When the writer sees that things are going well, he doesn't think much about them. But when things break, he snaps to attention and starts applying his problem-solving skills. So when your kids are making A's and B's, you don't think much about their grades. But when they make a D or an F, you spring into action. It's weird when you think about it, isn't it? What if the writer had a more positive orientation? Imagine a world in which you experienced a rush of gratitude every single time you flipped a light switch and the room lit up. Imagine a world in which, after a husband forgot his wife's birthday, She gave him a big kiss and said, "For 13 of the last 14 years, you remembered my birthday. That's wonderful. This is not our world. But in times of change, it needs to be. Our writer has a problem focus when he needs a solution focus. If you are a manager, ask yourself, what is the ratio of the time I spend solving problems to the time I spend scaling successes? We need to switch from archaeological problem solving to bright spot evangelizing. There is no question that it's possible to do. Take Jerry Sternin. He came into an environment riddled with failure. The opportunities for analysis were endless. He could have stayed in Vietnam for 20 years writing position papers on the malnutrition problem. But what he knew was this. Even in failure, there is success. An alcoholic goes an hour without a drink. 3 sales reps out of 50 sell like crazy. A few Vietnamese mothers, with no more money than any others, manage to raise healthy kids. These flashes of success, these bright spots, can illuminate the roadmap for action and spark the hope that change is possible. Chapter 3. Script the Critical Moves. 1. A doctor was asked to consider the medical records of a 67-year-old patient who had chronic hip pain from arthritis. In the past, the patient had been given drugs to treat his pain, but they'd been ineffective. So the doctor was forced to consider a more drastic option, hip replacement surgery, which involves slicing open the thigh, wrenching the bone out of the socket, sawing off the arthritic end, and replacing it with an implant. Recovery from hip replacement surgery is long and painful. Then came an unexpected break in the case. A final check with the patient's pharmacy uncovered one medication that hadn't been tried. Now the doctor faced a dilemma. Should he prescribe the untried medication, even though other medications had failed, or should he go ahead and refer the patient for surgery? This dilemma, based on real medical cases, was created by physician Donald Rettelmeyer and psychologist Eldar Shafir, who used it to study the way doctors make decisions. When doctors were presented with this case history, 47% of them chose to try the medication in hopes of saving the patient from going under the knife. In a variation on the dilemma, another group of doctors were presented with almost exactly the same set of case facts, except this time, the patient's pharmacy discovered 2 untried medications. If you were the patient with the arthritic hip, you'd be thrilled. Certainly, 2 non-surgical options were better than 1. But when the doctors were presented with 2 medications, only 28% chose to try either one. This doesn't make sense. The doctors were acting as though having more medication options somehow made medication a worse bet than surgery. But if 47% of doctors thought medication A was preferable to surgery, the mere existence of a second medication shouldn't have tipped them towards surgery. What happened here is decision paralysis. More options, even good ones, can freeze us and make us retreat to the default plan, which in this case was a painful and invasive hip replacement surgery. This behavior is clearly not rational, but it is human. Decisions are the rider's turf because they require careful supervision and self-control. They tax the rider's strength. Remember the radish chocolate chip cookie study from Chapter 1? The more choices the rider is offered, the more exhausted the rider gets. Have you ever noticed that shopping is a lot more tiring than other kinds of light activity? Now you know why. It's all those choices. This is important because we encounter excess choice all around us. Consider 3 real examples of decision paralysis. Scene 1, a gourmet food store. The store managers have set up a table where customers can sample imported jams for free. One day, the table showcases 6 different jams. Another day, 24 jams. As you'd expect, the 24-jam display attracts more customers to stop by for a sample. But when it comes time to buy, they can't make a decision. Shoppers who saw only 6 jams on display are 10 times more likely to buy a jar of jam. Scene 2. The office. the employees of a large company read over their 401k materials, ready to start saving for retirement. The Human Resources Department has thoughtfully provided many investment options: domestic growth stock funds, domestic value stock funds, municipal bond funds, real estate investment trusts, emerging market funds, developed market funds, money market accounts, and more. Each category might have several choices within it. Really complete 401k plans might offer dozens of options. The extra options backfire, however, because for every 10 options offered, the employee's rate of participation goes down by 2%. Decision paralysis deters people from saving for their own retirement, and because many companies match employees' contributions, employees may also be walking away from free money. Scene 3. A local bar. It's speed dating night. Singles meet a series of other singles one-on-one, spending perhaps 5 minutes with each person in hopes of making a romantic connection. But decision paralysis thwarts even Cupid. Young adults who meet 8 other singles make more matches than those who meet 20. Bottom line, decision paralysis disrupts medical decisions and retail decisions and investment decisions and dating decisions. Let's go out on a limb and suggest that it might affect decisions in your job and life, too. Think about the sources of decision paralysis in your organization. Every business must choose among attractive options: growing revenue quickly versus maximizing profitability, making perfect products versus getting products to market faster, being innovative and creative versus optimizing efficiency. If you fold together lots of those tensions, you create a surefire recipe for paralysis. It took only 2 medications to fuzz the doctor's brains. How many options do your people have? Think about your local school board. Every year, the problems and solutions multiply. You can just imagine the mental conversation. Property tax revenue is falling, but the teachers need a 3% cost of living raise, and we can't forget about extracurriculars. Cutting the marching band last year was a killer. But we must continue to invest in our new science magnet school. If it doesn't work, there will be egg on our face. Yet it's ridiculous to consider any of this until we fix our crumbling infrastructure and address our overcrowded classrooms. For the frazzled school board member, it suddenly looks a lot more attractive to roll over last year's budget with a 1.5% increase on every line item. As Barry Schwartz puts it in his book, The Paradox of Choice, as we face more and more options, we become overloaded. Choice no longer liberates, it debilitates. It might even be said to tyrannize. 2. The status quo feels comfortable and steady because much of the choice has been squeezed out. You have your routines, your ways of doing things. For most of your day, the rider is on autopilot. But in times of change, autopilot doesn't work anymore. Choices suddenly proliferate, and autopilot habits become unfamiliar decisions. When you're on a diet, the habitual daily trip for Nachos Bel Grande is disqualified, and in its place is left a decision. When you've got a new manager, the way you communicate stops being second nature and starts being a choice. Change brings new choices that create uncertainty. Let's be clear. It's not only options that yield decision paralysis, like picking one donut from 100 flavors. Ambiguity does too. In times of change, you may not know what options are available, and this uncertainty leads to decision paralysis as surely as a table with 24 jams. Ambiguity is exhausting to the rider because the rider is tugging on the reins of the elephant, trying to direct the elephant down a new path. But when the road is uncertain, the elephant will insist on taking the default path, the most familiar path, just as the doctors did. Why? Because uncertainty makes the elephant anxious. Think of how, in an unfamiliar place, you gravitate toward a familiar face. And that's why decision paralysis can be deadly for change, because the most familiar path is always the status quo. Many leaders pride themselves on setting high-level direction. I'll set the vision and stay out of the details. It's true that a compelling vision is critical, as we'll see in the next chapter, but it's not enough. Big-picture hands-off leadership isn't likely to work in a change situation, because the hardest part of change, the paralyzing part, is precisely in the details. In Chapter 1, we explained why what looks like resistance is often a lack of clarity. The citizens of two West Virginia communities, unhealthy in their eating habits, underwent a major change when a couple of professors coached them to buy 1% milk. They didn't need a big-picture vision. No one needs convincing that eating healthy is an admirable goal. What they needed was someone who could bring a noble goal within the realm of everyday behavior. Someone who could cut through the bewildering array of potentially healthy choices and suggest a good place to start. Ambiguity is the enemy. Any successful change requires a translation of ambiguous goals into concrete behaviors. In short, to make a switch, you need to script the critical moves. 3. In 1995, Brazilian President Fernando Henrique Cardoso decided to privatize Brazil's railroads. He split the system into 7 different branches, shades of Ma Bell, and auctioned off the rights to run them. Previous administrations had not invested much in the rail system, and at the time of the auction, it was a deteriorating mess. A study concluded that 50% of the network's bridges needed repair, and 20% of them were on the verge of collapse. The technologies used in Brazil were far behind those in other developed countries. In fact, the rail system was still using 20 locomotives powered by steam engines. A private firm, GP Investimentos Limited, decided to bid for the branch known as the Southern Line, which ran through Brazil's 3 southernmost states. GP was high bidder in the auction in December 1996. After an interim period of management, the firm put one of its own executives, Alexander Behring, in charge of the company, which was later renamed America Latina Logistica, ALL. When Behring took charge, he was in his early 30s, just 4 years out of business school. Behring didn't have much to work with. ALL had only 30 million Brazilian reals in cash on its balance sheet. At one of Behring's first meetings, a mid-level manager beseeched him for 5 million reals to repair a single bridge. Though sympathetic, Behring knew that fixing everything that was broken would require hundreds of millions of reals. The needs were profound, but he faced an unyielding constraint: ALL's depleted bank account. The railroad purchased by GP was in chaos, and when Behring and his team took charge, with new personnel and new priorities, more chaos was whipped into the pre-existing chaos. The resulting decision paralysis should have been inescapable, and it likely would have been if Behring hadn't made clear exactly what needed to be done. His top priority was to lift ALL out of its precarious, cash-strapped financial state. To accomplish this, he and his 35-year-old CFO, Duilio Calciolari, developed 4 rules to govern the company's investments. Rule 1. Money would be invested only in projects that would allow ALL to earn more revenue in the short term. Rule 2. The best solution to any problem was the one that would cost the least money up front, even if it ended up costing more in the long term, and even if it was a lower quality solution. Rule 3. Options that would fix a problem quickly were preferred to slower options that would provide superior long-term fixes. Rule 4. Reusing or recycling existing materials was better than acquiring new materials. The 4 rules were clear. 1. Unblock revenue. 2. Minimize upfront cash. 3. Faster is better than best. 4. Use what you've got. These rules, taken together, ensured that cash wouldn't be consumed unless it was being used as bait for more cash. Spend a little, make a little more. This is what we mean by scripting the critical moves. Change begins at the level of individual decisions and behaviors, but that's a hard place to start because that's where the friction is. Inertia and decision paralysis will conspire to keep people doing things the old way. To spark movement in a new direction, you need to provide crystal clear guidance. That's why scripting is important. You've got to think about the specific behavior that you'd want to see in a tough moment, whether the tough moment takes place in a Brazilian railroad system or late at night in your own snack-loaded pantry. You can't script every move. That would be like trying to foresee the 17th move in a chess game. It's the critical moves that count. Recall that in West Virginia, the researchers decided to focus their campaign on milk because it was the source of the most saturated fat in the average diet. The researchers didn't offer suggestions about bread or soda or butter or potato chips. They scripted the critical move, switch to 1% milk. Similarly, Behring's four rules were focused on financial triage. He didn't have the luxury of long-term planning. He needed his people to move immediately in a new direction in hopes that they could buy ALL enough time to make a fuller transformation. Notice that he didn't say a word about the other important issues, such as employee morale or marketing or R&D. By staying focused on the critical moves, he made it easier for his people to change direction. In 1998, for instance, the company had to turn down business hauling grain because it didn't have enough locomotives. While its competitors were negotiating for new locomotives, ALL's engineers worked around the clock repairing old locomotives. Faster is better than best. Minimize upfront cash. Also, ALL's engineers figured out a way to boost the locomotive's fuel capacity so they could operate longer without refueling. This reduced downtime, allowing more routes per locomotive, just as Southwest Airlines gets more flights per plane than its competitors because of its quick turnarounds at the gate. Unblock revenue. Engineers also found a creative solution to the nagging problem of damaged tracks, which limited a train's speed. Rather than purchasing new metal rails, which cost US$400 per ton, they ripped up tracks at abandoned stations and installed them on active routes. Use what you've got. 3 years later, Behring's discipline was paying off. ALL's performance improved from a net loss of 80 million reals in 1998 to a net profit of 24 million reals in 2000. Knowing what we know about the rider, it's no surprise that Behring's strategy worked. Behring had scripted the moves that helped his people make hard decisions. What tires out the rider and puts change efforts at risk is ambiguity, and Behring eliminated it. For every investment decision, his rules suggested the correct choice. To see the power of this, let's return to the doctors and the patient with the arthritic hip. Imagine that the leaders of the hospital had scripted their critical moves, and that one of those moves was this. Use invasive options only as a last resort. Does anyone doubt that this guideline would have caused a big shift in the doctor's decisions? 4. In what follows, we present a feature that we call a clinic. In each clinic, we describe a real-world situation and challenge you to think about how to apply the switch framework to create change. At the end of each clinic, we give our own suggestions, but we encourage you to generate your own game plan before you look at ours. The clinic is intended to be a kind of pause button, a chance to step outside the text and think about how to apply what you've read. We hope you find this a useful way to practice applying the framework. The clinics are written to be sidebars. And here's the first one. Can you get people to file their expense reports on time? Situation. Barbara, the controller of a consulting firm, is fuming again about expense reports. Why do people always turn them in late? The monthly due date was yesterday, and she's still missing 38% of the reports. That puts pressure on members of her team, especially on Maria, the expense czar, because they're expected to close the company's monthly books on time, and the expense reports are a necessary input to the close. Frustrated, Barbara starts composing a reminder email, full of underlined words and exclamation points. The nag email has become a monthly tradition. Why does she have to shout before people do what they're supposed to do? This is a fictional situation that is inspired by a true story. Many true stories. What's the switch and what's holding it back? The behavior Barbara wants is clear. Employees need to file their expense reports by the deadline. It's not obvious what the barrier is. Maybe the process is sufficiently complicated that it paralyzes the rider. Maybe the process is perfectly clear, but the elephant always finds things it would rather be doing. Or maybe the reporting systems are so antiquated that the path is one giant speed bump. Let's attack on all three fronts. How do we make the switch? Direct the rider. 1. Find the bright spots. Barbara should investigate her bright spots. the 62% of employees who file their expense reports on time every month. What are they doing differently? Maybe they've handcrafted a set of techniques for logging expenses as they occur, so there's not a big pile at the end of the month. Once Barbara figures out the bright spots tricks, she can get them to share their system with others. 2. Script the critical moves. It's possible that parts of the reporting process are confusing enough to cause decision paralysis. Maybe there is ambiguity about how to code particular expenses or how to allocate certain costs between clients. Barbara should observe a few laggards as they complete their reports. She won't know how to script the critical moves until she sees the confusion firsthand. Motivate the elephant. 1. Find the feeling. Nobody who misses an expense report deadline feels anything. Sure, Barbara chastises laggards via email, but after they've received the nag note for the 6th consecutive month, it loses its sting. Barbara needs to find something people can care about. Or someone. After all, the company depends on people like Maria to close the books every month, and they'll be held accountable if they blow the deadline. So in essence, the goal is not to file the report, it's to do Maria a favor once a month. It may be easy to rationalize missing an administrative deadline, but it's harder to rationalize letting down a coworker who's counting on you. Shape the path. 1. Tweak the environment. How easy are the expense report forms to fill out? The accounting department should be obsessive about simplifying them, to the point of preloading people's names in their reports and distributing empty envelopes for loose receipts. Think Amazon's one-click ordering. Every barrier that's removed makes the path clearer. 2. Rally the herd. Many people may conclude falsely that everyone turns in the reports late, that lateness is an accepted behavior. Barbara's nagging emails may actually reinforce this perception. Why would she send them unless lots of people are slacking? People are sensitive to social norms, so Barbara's email should highlight the fact that almost two-thirds of reports are turned in on time. No one likes to hear that they're underperforming relative to their peers. 5. When Alexandra Baring set up 4 simple rules for ALL employees to follow, they changed quickly. So did the West Virginians who were urged to drink 1% milk. But why did these changes need to be scripted? Wasn't it obvious to the West Virginians that they should be drinking 1% milk instead of whole milk? Well, no, it wasn't. Not many people know that a glass of whole milk has the same amount of saturated fat as 5 bacon strips. That's not intuitive knowledge. Nor was it intuitive for any of Baring's employees at ALL to decide, yep, let's rip up old abandoned tracks instead of purchasing new ones. When you want someone to behave in a new way, explain the new way clearly. Don't assume the new moves are obvious. To see why this is so important, consider a campaign that is essentially the antimatter version of the 1% milk campaign. A campaign that, while well-intentioned, systematically ignores or reverses every smart component of the 1% milk intervention. What would such an antimatter campaign look like? It might look very much like the U.S. government's food pyramid. The food pyramid, which specifies the types and quantities of food that make up a healthy diet, is the perfect example of how not to change people's behavior. It's worth considering a moment because what dooms the pyramid could doom your efforts to create change in your life as well. Let's start with the pyramid shape. A pyramid signifies hierarchy, yet no hierarchy is evident in the food pyramid. The first version of it displayed rows of food, one row on top of the next, with grains at the bottom and oils at the top. Some people interpreted this arrangement to mean that oils were the most important food group. Whoops. The revised version abandoned that construct for vertical-ish streaks of color intended to eliminate any implied ranking. What this means is that the pyramid structure itself has no meaning whatsoever. The food pyramid might as well be a food rhombus or a food rooster. Consider it again. Its meaning is almost completely opaque. What do these colored streaks mean? The only meaning that can be gleaned quickly comes from a stick figure dashing up the side. The meaning is clear enough. You should exercise. The answers to more meaningful questions, how much, how often, what kind, aren't as easy to infer, which of course adds more ambiguity. To learn what the food pyramid has to say about food, you must be willing to decipher the pyramid's markings. If you make an effort, you'll find that each streak of color represents a class of food. For instance, a tiny yellow streak is oils, and an orange streak is grains. If you dig even further, you'll find that with every color streak comes a recommendation. For instance, the USDA advises that adults consume about 5 to 7 teaspoons of oil each day. Quick, how many teaspoons of oil did you consume today? Quick, how many ounce equivalents of grain did you have today? Can you imagine any message that would be less effective in changing people's eating behavior? The language and the concepts here are so hopelessly abstracted from people's actual experience with food, which consists of things like buying groceries and ordering hamburgers at restaurants, not tabulating grain portions, that the message confuses and demoralizes. I can't understand this stuff. As an analogy, most of us have internalized the rule of thumb to get the oil in our cars changed every 3 months or 3,000 miles. It's transparent and actionable, like the 1% milk campaign. What if instead the auto industry publicized its version of the disastrous food pyramid, say, a car rainbow, where each color of the rainbow represents a different diagnostic test? Pink would warn you not to let your engine oil exceed a certain sludge threshold. Jiffy Lube would be out of business in months. Okay, the food pyramid is almost too easy to pick on. But the lessons here are serious and practical. If you are leading a change effort, you need to remove the ambiguity from your vision of change. Granted, this is asking a lot. It means that you'll need to understand how to script the critical moves, to translate aspirations into actions. It's not good enough to ask your team to be more creative or to tighten up on the purse strings. That's like telling the American public to be healthier. In a pioneering study of organizational change, described in the book The Critical Path to Corporate Renewal, researchers divided the change efforts they'd studied into three groups: the most successful, the top third, the average, the middle third, and the least successful, the bottom third. They found that across the spectrum, almost everyone set goals, 89% of the top third and 86% of the bottom third. A typical goal might be to improve inventory turns by 50%. But the more successful change transformations were more likely to set behavioral goals. 89% of the top third versus only 33% of the bottom third. For instance, a behavioral goal might be that project teams would meet once a week and each team would include at least one representative of every functional area. Until you can ladder your way down from a change idea to a specific behavior, you're not ready to lead a switch. To create movement, you've got to be specific and be concrete. You've got to emulate 1% milk and flee from the food pyramid. 6. How far does this theory go? How much difference can specific instructions make? Let's subject the idea to the toughest possible test. Can you change child abusers by scripting some critical parenting moves for them? In 2004, a study was conducted of 110 parents who had abused their children. 73% of them had assaulted their kids, hitting or punching them with their fists. 20% had engaged in even more violent assaults, resulting in broken bones or severe lacerations. The parents tended to blame their abusive behavior on their kids. They'll say, "I had to discipline my child this way because he's so rotten and he won't listen," said Beverly Funderburk, a research professor at the University of Oklahoma's Health Sciences Center. The parents believed that they'd gotten a bad kid, or a stubborn one, and that violence was the only way they could get their kids to obey. The mission of Funderburk's team was to change these parents, to stop their abuse. If you think that sounds naive and even hopeless, you're in good company. That's also what Funderburk worried about when she first began the work. She practices what's called parent-child interaction therapy, PCIT, which tries to disrupt the escalating cycles of coercion and frustration that characterizes abusive situations. In the first step of PCIT, parents are given an assignment. We want you to play with your child for 5 minutes a day. Here are the rules. You're going to devote 100% of your attention to them. You're not going to answer the phone. You are not going to teach them their ABCs. You're just going to enjoy them. The parents are incredulous that 5 minutes will accomplish anything. For goodness sake, said one parent, I spend every minute of every day on this child. At first, these 5-minute play periods take place in a laboratory setting. The parent and child sit in an empty room with only a table and chairs. 3 or 4 toys are put on the tabletop. The parents are instructed to let the child lead the play session, and they're forbidden to give commands, to criticize, even to ask questions. Letting their child direct the action is incredibly difficult for them. During the play session, a therapist watches the parents through a one-way mirror and gives real-time coaching by means of an earpiece. Funderburk describes a typical interaction. The parent and the child might start coloring, and the parent tries to play along by coloring on the child's paper. The child objects, so we tell the parent, okay, get a separate piece of paper and imitate what your child is doing. If the child is coloring a rainbow, the parent colors a rainbow too, saying, I'm coloring a rainbow just like you. You're using green. I'm going to use green. And some kids, if they're particularly oppositional, might reach over and grab the parent's green crayon, yelling, I want that. And we teach the parents to say, okay, I'd be happy to share that crayon with you. In fact, let me put all the crayons over by you so you can reach them all. Or perhaps the parent says, I'm going to color my rainbow with pink now. And the child says, pink is ugly. Don't do pink. If the child has been particularly nasty, we may just ask the parents to ignore the comment. But otherwise, we coach the parents to agree with their child. You're right. Pink is not a good color for the rainbow. I think I'll do red. We try to get the parents to bend like a reed. Whatever the child is doing, the parent offers no resistance, so the child has nothing to fight against. An abusive parent typically finds the 5-minute exercise utterly exhausting. And you understand why. The parent's rider has to supervise every single moment. Funderburk and her colleagues demand that the parents practice the same set of behaviors, called child-directed interaction, every day, whether in the lab or at home, so that the behaviors gradually become instinctive. The more instinctive a behavior becomes, the less self-control from the rider it requires, and thus, the more sustainable it becomes. Parents are taught skills that feel unnatural at first. They are taught to look for opportunities to praise their kids' behavior. I like how hard you're working. Good job. You're being very kind to that doll. They are taught to simply describe their child's behavior so that the child feels noticed. Oh, look, now you're putting the car in the garage. Later in the program, after parents have become better at having short positive interactions with their kids, they are taught how to give commands so that their kids will listen and obey. They are taught a very specific formula for a command, combining a command with a reason so the command doesn't feel arbitrary. Johnny, it's almost time for the bus to come, so please put your shoes on now. Funderburk and her team at the University of Oklahoma studied 110 parents who had abused their children. Half of them were randomly assigned to take 12 sessions of PCIT, and the other half were assigned to take 12 sessions of a form of anger management therapy, focused on helping them control their emotions, the standard treatment for abusive parents. After the therapy sessions concluded, the parents were tracked for 3 years. Across 3 years, 60% of the anger management therapy group committed another act of child abuse. In contrast, only 20% of the PCIT parents reoffended. PCIT did not eliminate the problem. 1 in 5 parents abused his or her kids again. But, from the perspective of behavior change, the results are staggering. Most of us believe in our hearts that child abusers are irredeemably flawed. Who could hit a child other than someone who is disturbed in some basic way? It simply boggles the mind to think that the behavior of child abusers could be altered by only 12 sessions of therapy, concentrating on such simple instructions. Funderburk said, in my experience, the physically abusive parent has the same goals as a normal parent. It's their method and their ideas that are wrong. They think their child is woeful because they told their 3-year-old to just play in the front yard, and then he wandered off into the street. And they don't understand that a 3-year-old might forget an instruction, or might not have that kind of impulse control. So they think they have to punish the child for his own good, because he was disobedient and dangerous. Earlier, we said what looks like stubbornness or opposition may actually be a lack of clarity. The PCIT intervention suggests that child abuse, too, may be partly the result of a lack of understanding, a lack of clear instruction or guidance on what to do. This is not to excuse the parents' behavior, of course. It is simply to point out that simple scripting has power beyond what any of us could have predicted. Even child abusers become pliable in its presence. 7. In 1995, the same year Brazil's President Cardoso announced the privatization of the railroads, a group of high school students in Howard, South Dakota, started plotting a revival. They wanted to do something, anything, that might revive their dying community. Howard and surrounding Minor County had been shrinking for decades. Farm and industrial jobs had slowly dried up, and nothing replaced them. The median price of houses in Howard was only $26,500. The population was about 3,000 and shrinking. The county had the highest elderly population per capita in South Dakota, and it also had the highest rate of youth outmigration in South Dakota, meaning that when young people got old enough, they left and didn't return. "We'd been in decline for 90 years," said Randy Perry, a longtime resident who taught a business class at the local high school, coached the varsity basketball team, and ran an ice cream parlor on the side. At Howard High School, the students had just finished reading a book about the death of rural communities in Iowa. The students said, "That's us. It's just 70 years from now," according to Perry. So in class, they started asking, "How could we change this?" Imagine the decision paralysis in this situation. Think of how many factors influence a town's health: its history, its demographics, its location, its economic base, its weather, among countless others. The problem was simply too complex for anyone to solve. And it wasn't for lack of motivation. There wasn't one person in Minor County who wouldn't have jumped at the chance to help rejuvenate the community. The elephant herd was ready to move, but where? What can a few people do to restore an entire county? The students started investigating the situation, designing a survey and distributing it to a sample of Minor County's 1,000 registered voters. One finding in particular disturbed them. They discovered that half of the residents were shopping outside the county, driving an hour to Sioux Falls to shop in larger stores. If Minor County was going to be reborn, its economy would need a boost. Most of the things that would boost an economy, investment, entrepreneurship, immigration, were out of the students' control. But they had uncovered one thing that was very much in their control: spending money locally. They had found their first rallying cry: "Let's keep Minor dollars in Minor County." Perry urged the students to present their findings to the community. The students accepted the challenge and began to put together a presentation. The students' newfound interest in revitalization dovetailed with the efforts of others in the community. A group of other Minor County citizens had been hosting a series of meetings intended to get county residents talking about the future. They held 5 gatherings, some in the high school and some in people's homes, and they invited a cross-section of residents, farmers and business people and ministers and retirees. They challenged each other. What can we do to energize Minor County? The issues raised were all over the map. Why does our town look so shabby with rusty cars on the street? Why should a farmer get a subsidy when a business person doesn't get a subsidy? Why don't we have a more thriving Main Street? Many of the issues were TBU, unsolvable by the community. Many required investment, but with a limited pool of tax dollars to draw from. It wasn't clear where they'd find the money, but there were a few things they knew they could take into their own hands. A gas station owner in the town of Fedora, population 150, complained that residents years ago had cut down a lot of diseased trees. Stumps were still littering the area, making Fedora look run down and sad. A group of concerned citizens decided to deal with the stumps in Fedora. One Saturday, farmers carrying chainsaws rode into Fedora on their tractors and loaders. Other residents made sandwiches and cookies for the workers. In a single day, the group dug up 400 stumps. Kathy Callies, who was heading up the kitchen crew that day, said it was amazing to see 50 people, ages ranging from 5 to 95, come together to do something for their community. Callies recalled that by the end of the day, people felt like, look at what we did in a day. And when you've dug up stumps together, and you start to realize you have shared ideas about what you want the community to be, then things start to happen. Notice that the log clearing day had powerful elephant and path elements as well. The flush of victory, of making a difference, gave the elephant strength to continue, and the strong support of the community made the path feel less difficult. It's easier to make a long journey when you've got a herd around you. The community began to rally around the movement. Callies remembered the day that Phyllis, a civic-minded woman in her 80s, dropped by the office where the community boosters were meeting. Phyllis announced, I've been waiting for you to call me. I thought if you needed my help, you would call. But then I realized, oh, they're all too busy to call. So here I am. On her refrigerator at home, Phyllis had posted a cross stitch that said, screw the golden years. When the high school students were ready to unveil their recommendations, 85 residents gathered in the high school gym to hear the presentation. Among them were the top leaders of the towns in Minor County, the school boards, the city councils, and city commissioners. The crowd listened attentively to the high school students. Perry said, you could hear a pin drop. People said, I can't say no because I want to make this a place where these kids can come home someday. Because the other option is we sit here and keep watching these things decline. Pretty soon all that will be left is the dust. The students had prepared an impressive array of spreadsheets and charts and graphs. But they'd also simplified the complex data into one simple surprising fact. They'd calculated that if Howard residents spent just 10% more of their disposable income at home, they would boost the local economy by $7 million. The audience was impressed, and the presentation worked better than anyone expected. The students had scripted the first critical move for Minor County, and the locals responded immediately, consciously spending more of their money in the county. A year later, South Dakota's Department of Revenue released an astonishing number. The amount of money spent in Minor County had increased by $15.6 million, more than twice the increase the kids had expected. The change began to snowball, suddenly because the county was collecting more taxes. Money was available to fund the other proposals the local groups had considered. And in the years following the students' presentation, the tax receipts kept climbing, which enabled the community to tackle even more ambitious problems. Later, Howard and Minor County received $6 million in grants from various foundations to fuel the transformation. Randy Perry left his teaching job and became a full-time revitalizer-in-chief. The town of Howard became the host to 21st-century businesses such as an organic beef producer and a wind turbine repair shop. It all started small, said Perry. It's like when I took over the basketball team at the high school. They were just coming off a losing season, and you couldn't get people to come into the gym. But then you start to win, and a few people come, and then more people come. And then we started winning a lot. To date, Perry has discussed the rebirth of Minor County with community leaders from 33 different states. 8. A railroad and a small South Dakota town, both crumbling, both with a dense thicket of problems and no real resources to use in untangling them. In each situation, an unlikely leader emerged. A young man fresh out of business school, and a high school basketball coach, and both succeeded by formulating solutions that were strikingly smaller than the problems they were intended to solve. We've seen this asymmetry before in the stories of Jerry Sternin in Vietnam and Bobby, the troubled teenager. The challenges facing Minor County were big and sprawling. The decline of an industrial base, the aging of a population. The citizens understood these challenges well, but the knowledge was TBU, true but useless. It was paralyzing knowledge. To the rider, a big problem calls for a big solution. But if you seek out a solution that's as complex as the problem, you'll get the food pyramid, and nothing will change. The rider will just spin his wheels trying to make sense of it. The rider has to be jarred out of introspection, out of analysis. He needs a script that explains how to act, and that's why the successes we've seen have involved such crisp direction. Buy 1% milk. Don't spend cash unless it makes cash. Shop a little more in Minor County. We all hear a lot of common sense wisdom about change. People don't like to change. People resist change. People are set in their ways. People are stubborn. But here, we've seen something else entirely. Railroads made profitable, towns reborn, diets changed, and child abusers reformed. Clarity dissolves resistance. Chapter 4. Point to the Destination. 1. Crystal Jones joined Teach for America in 2003. She was assigned to teach the first grade class at an elementary school in Atlanta, Georgia. The school had no kindergarten, so for many of the kids, Jones would be their first teacher. At the beginning of the year, the skill gaps among her students were daunting. She said, "I had two or three students who could recognize kindergarten sight words, and I also had some that couldn't even hold their pencils. The ones who had never been to school, their basic behavior wasn't where it needed to be for them to be in the classroom. I had students that, of course, didn't know their alphabet or their numbers. They were all on different levels, and no one was really where they needed to be for first grade." Jones felt confident that she could elevate the kids' abilities. She could create great lesson plans and activities. She could script the critical moves. But to what end? How do you show a room full of first graders where they're headed and why going there is worth the effort in terms they can understand? Well, here's a way not to do that, from another Teach for America teacher who reported her goals for the year as follows. With respect to reading for the school year, I administered three diagnostics, CWT, Assessment of Comprehension and Monster Test. Using the CWT, I identified my class's average as grade level 1.5 in September. My goal is to increase my students' word identification so as to ensure a class average of 3.0. Upon analyzing the results of the assessment of comprehension, I identified my class's average as 41% in September. My goal is to increase my students' comprehension so as to ensure a class average of 80%. Using the Monster Test, I identified my class's average score as semiphonetic phonetic. My goal is to increase my students' phonics and spelling skills to transitional. That ambitious and specific set of goals was probably quite useful to the teacher in her planning, but it obviously won't be useful in lighting a fire in the hearts of first graders. Crystal Jones, in contrast, knew that if she wanted to motivate the kids, she had to speak their language. At the beginning of the school year, she announced a goal for her class that she knew would captivate every student. By the end of this school year, you're going to be third graders. Not literally, of course, but in the sense that they would be at third grade skill levels. That goal was tailor-made for the first grade psyche. First graders know very well what third graders look like. They are bigger, smarter, cooler. You know the feeling you get when you're admiring the grace and power of an Olympic athlete? That's the feeling first graders get about third graders. Jones chose the goal carefully. She knew exactly what the third grade standards in Georgia required, and she knew where her kids were starting. She genuinely thought she could close the gap. One of her first efforts was to cultivate a culture of learning in her classroom, calling her students scholars and asking them to address one another that way. When people visited her classroom, she introduced her class as a group of scholars and asked them to define the term for the guest. They would shout, "A scholar is someone who lives to learn and is good at it." The scholars were encouraged to go home and share what they learned with their families. One day, a scholar was called out of the classroom for administrative reasons, and some of the others in the room started groaning. In most classrooms, it would have been a groan of jealousy. "Get me out of here, too!" Jones realized, to her surprise, that it was a groan of pity. "That kid is going to miss some scholar work." At that moment, Jones said, "I knew I had them." By springtime, the kids' test scores had reached second grade level, So Jones threw a graduation ceremony right before spring break. For the rest of the year, the kids took pleasure in referring to themselves as second graders. And by the end of the year, over 90% of the kids were reading at or above third grade level. These were some of the same kids who 9 months earlier didn't know the alphabet. Crystal Jones's challenge is reminiscent of what Jim Collins and Jerry Porras in Built to Last, their great study of long-lived business organizations, memorably called a BHAG, a big, hairy, audacious goal. Henry Ford's BHAG early in the 20th century was to democratize the automobile. Walmart in 1990 set the goal of quadrupling in size to be a $125 billion company by the year 2000. Collins and Porras defined a BHAG as an audacious 10 to 30 year goal to progress towards an envisioned future, and their research showed that setting these big motivating goals was a practice that distinguished lasting companies from less successful ones. In creating change, though, we're interested in goals that are closer at hand, the kinds of things that can be tackled by parents or middle managers or social activists. We want a goal that can be tackled in months or years, not decades. We want what we might call a destination postcard, a vivid picture from the near-term future that shows what could be possible. That's the missing piece of what we've discussed so far. We've seen the importance of pursuing bright spots, and we've discussed ways of instructing the rider how to behave, but we haven't answered a very basic question. Where are we headed in the end? What's the destination? Crystal Jones provided a great destination postcard. You'll be third graders soon. Notice that the goal she set for her students didn't only direct the rider, it also motivated the elephant. It was inspirational. It tapped into feeling. Collins and Porras knew that goals should have an emotional component. A BHAG shouldn't just be big and compelling. It should hit you in the gut. To a first grader, becoming a third grader in 9 months is a gut-smacking goal. 2. Women with breast cancer flew to San Francisco to be treated by Laura Esserman, a surgeon and an associate professor of surgery at the University of California at San Francisco, UCSF. Patients loved Esserman for her warmth and empathy. She gave out her personal cell phone number to her patients, and she sometimes sang patients to sleep in the operating room as their anesthesia took effect. Esserman's human touch was in sharp contrast to the usual treatment afforded women diagnosed with breast cancer. As if the diagnosis itself weren't frightening enough, women were often bounced around from place to place during the treatment cycle, adding stress. In a typical progression, described by a Stanford case study, a woman first notices a lump on her breast during a monthly self-exam. Anxious, she calls a doctor and waits a few days or weeks for an appointment. The doctor confirms that the lump should be examined. So, the patient is referred to a radiologist at another facility to get a mammogram. Getting the results of the scan takes another agonizing few days. The mammogram shows something suspicious, so she is referred to a surgeon who meets her and again verifies that the lump is present. Unfortunately, the mammogram images didn't arrive at the surgeon's office before the visit, so there's another delay while radiology is contacted. The surgeon conducts a biopsy, which is sent to the pathology department to determine whether the growth contains cancerous cells. The woman is sent home to wait by the phone for the answer. If cancer is detected, she undergoes surgery, and then the surgeon refers her to a radiation therapist for radiation treatment and to a medical oncologist for chemotherapy. Radiation and chemotherapy are conducted at different sites with different booking procedures and delays. In an attempt to smooth the process, a patient might have to collect her own records, films, and pathology slides and carry them around herself, sometimes even within the same hospital. The sequence might take weeks to unfold. And all while the woman is wondering, am I going to live through this? This anxiety-filled process appalled Laura Esserman, and she had a vision of how it could be different. What if there were a breast care clinic where a woman worried about a lump in her breast could walk in at the beginning of the day and walk out at the end of the day with an answer, either knowing that the lump was no problem, or if it was a problem, having a treatment plan already in hand. The main barrier to this vision was the lack of coordination among medical departments. If they could be integrated more tightly, then weeks of agonizing waiting could be eliminated. The patient would not have to leave the building, and the experience would be designed around the patient's needs, not the department's. That was Esserman's destination postcard, and it was an admirable one. But as an associate professor at a large university medical center, Esserman was far down the totem pole, with few resources at her disposal. Even if she could start a breast care clinic, she would never be able to hire or fire people who might work for it, and she couldn't even set their salaries. The medical departments, such as radiology and pathology, controlled the purse strings and the resources. The two most commonly used descriptions of the medical school at UCSF were bureaucratic and political. The departments have money and the departments have turf, and you can't bring them together, said Meredith Mendelson, who became Esserman's chief administrative director. Esserman said, "The radiation oncologists report to radiation oncology. The surgeons report to the School of Medicine. The medical oncologists report to medical oncology. The nurses and staff report to the medical center. The psychologists and social workers report someplace else." So it's an organizational challenge to make people feel like they belong to something. Because Esserman wielded so little institutional power, her best assets for creating change were her own tenacity and her ability to sell a vision of what breast cancer care could be. Esserman and Mendelson started small. They set up the breast care center to operate for 4 hours one day per week. They cajoled the medical departments to start working together in more integrated ways. It took practice and it took persistence. Radiology, which does the mammographies, works like a train station, said Mendelson. If your appointment's at 12:15, you're seen at 12:15, and that's how they operate. But Esserman's goal was to build treatment around the patient's needs, and those needs weren't always predictable enough to conform to radiology's schedule. Esserman worked with the radiologists to figure out how to create some flexibility in their traditionally rigid processes. "We couldn't take up too much of radiology's time," said Mendelson, "so they figured out how to improvise. Dr. Esserman would see the patient in the morning, and she was the only doctor that would do it. She was the guinea pig. And then she would send them off. Say, go have lunch, go shopping, come back at 1 o'clock. And during lunchtime, she would go to radiology, where she and the radiologist would sit and look through all of the images and decide what needed to happen next." For the first year, the center stuck with the one-day-per-week model. Then, once the work was going smoothly, Esserman expanded to 2 days per week. More surgeons started to get involved, and then nurses and counselors and support staff, and the snowball began. Eventually, the breast care center achieved enough success that it was offered an entire floor in a new cancer center being constructed by UCSF. "Where's radiology?" asked Esserman when she saw the layout. The cancer center master plan assumed that the radiology department would remain in its old building, but that would have made Esserman's everything-under-one-roof vision impossible. So she agreed to give up one-third of the breast care center's space to make room for a mammography unit on the same floor. Onlookers were shocked. Academic departments usually fought hard to secure space, and Esserman was giving up some of hers. Now Esserman had two powerful assets, a proper home for the center and a staff who increasingly embraced her vision for a new kind of care. Patients flocked to the breast cancer center. From 1997 to 2003, the number of patients seen per month skyrocketed from 175 to 1,300. In time, the center became a major source of revenue for UCSF and a recognized national leader in breast cancer care and research. The center evolved to be the place that Esserman described in her destination postcard. Here's how Esserman describes the way the patient's experience looks today. "When a patient comes into the breast care center, I can walk around the corner and look at her films that day. While she's in the room, we can do a biopsy and get the diagnosis in 5 minutes. We have a gynecologist on staff that specializes in fertility issues for women with breast cancer. And I have a psychologist and genetic counselor on staff that is one of the nurse practitioners. The patient stays in the same place and doesn't need to go anywhere. The breast care center also has a relaxing healing garden and a cafe that serves coffee. The boutique sells not only the usual flowers and gifts, but also wigs and scarves for the patients undergoing chemo. For the first time," said Esserman, "we put the woman at the center." 3. When you describe a compelling destination, you're helping to correct one of the writer's great weaknesses, the tendency to get lost in analysis. Our first instinct in most change situations is to offer up data to people's writers. Here's why we need to change. Here are the tables and graphs and charts that prove it. The writer loves this. He'll start poring over the data, analyzing it and poking holes in it, and he'll be inclined to debate you about the conclusions you've drawn. To the writer, the analyzing phase is often more satisfying than the doing phase, and that's dangerous for your switch. Notice what happens, though, when you point to an attractive destination. The writer starts applying his strengths to figuring out how to get there. For instance, after Esserman announced her under one roof vision, her team could start thinking through the implications of that. Let's see. We'll never pull that off unless we have access to radiology, so we'll need to give up some square footage to them. You have a choice about how to use the writer's energy. By default, he'll obsess about which way to move, or whether it's necessary to move at all. But you can redirect that energy to helping you navigate toward the destination. For that to happen, you need a gut-smacking goal, one that appeals to both writer and elephant. Think of Esserman's under one roof vision, or of Crystal Jones's challenge to her kids to become third graders. Goals in most organizations, however, lack emotional resonance. Instead, smart goals, goals that are specific, measurable, actionable, relevant, and timely, have become the norm. A typical SMART goal might be, my marketing campaign will generate 4,500 qualified sales leads for the sales group by the end of Q3 09. The specificity of SMART goals is a great cure for the worst sins of goal setting, ambiguity and irrelevance. We are going to delight our customers every day in every way, but SMART goals are better for steady-state situations than for change situations because the assumptions underlying them are that the goals are worthwhile. If you accept that generating 4,500 leads for the sales force is a great use of your time, the SMART goal will be effective. But if a new boss, pushing a new direction, assigns you the 4,500 leads goal, even though you've never handled lead generation before, then there might be trouble. SMART goals presume the emotion. They don't generate it. In looking for a goal that reaches the elephant, that hits people in the gut, you can't bank on SMART goals. There are some people whose hearts are set aflutter by goals such as improving the liquidity ratio by 30% over the next 18 months. They're called accountants. In the 1980s, a major study of corporate change efforts found that financial goals inspired successful change less well than did more emotional goals, such as the goal to provide better service to customers or to make more useful products. According to the researchers, effective visions expressed values that allow employees to identify with the organization. One manager at a glass company suggested, it's hard to get excited about 15% return on equity. Destination postcards do double duty. They show the rider where you're headed, and they show the elephant why the journey is worthwhile. Here's a clinic that addresses that. How can you get corporations to avoid short-term thinking? Situation. Judy Samuelson heads a policy think tank with the Aspen Institute called the Business and Society Program. It's committed to fighting short-termism in the business world. Samuelson points out that it's hard to solve global problems, global warming, poverty, energy needs, without the help of the business sector. After all, some businesses have more resources than entire countries. But businesses with a short-term focus can't afford to tackle long-term problems. Samuelson recounts a conversation with the CEO of a huge financial services firm. He tells her that he would like to be involved with the big issues of the day, but he points to the 90-day calendar posted on his wall and admits, "This is my reality." Translation: the public markets are forcing him to adopt a quarter-by-quarter focus. How can Samuelson, the leader of a small nonprofit, possibly influence such massive forces? How can she fight short-termism? This is an actual situation, ongoing as of 2009. We'll discuss some of Samuelson's strategy along with some of our own thinking. What's the switch and what's holding it back? We want executives to act with a longer-term mindset. So what's stopping them? First, there's a big rider problem here. We hope your radar went off when you read the phrase short-termism. It's useful as a one-word summary of the problem that Samuelson is fighting. But to provoke change, we've got to script the critical moves. A long-term mindset isn't a behavior. Second, there's a path problem. The culture of the stock market encourages short-term thinking. Interestingly, the elephant probably isn't the villain here. Most execs would prefer, all things being equal, to have a longer-term focus. That means motivation probably isn't our obstacle. Finally, let's be realistic. Samuelson is seeking a massive change. We can't expect to generate a magic bullet solution, but big changes can start with small steps. How can we improve Samuelson's odds? How do we make the switch? Direct the writer. 1. Script the critical moves. Samuelson finds a way to translate her big picture goal into specific behaviors. One insight. Let's convince executives to stop giving quarterly earnings guidance. Backstory. Investors know the bizarre kabuki dance of earnings guidance, but other people may not. Each quarter, a public company sets expectations for the earnings per share it will deliver in its next quarterly financial report. Then, when the company files its report, a miracle occurs. The company announces that it beat the expectations by a penny per share. Oh, glory! The markets find this little game inspiring, but none of it is required by law. A company could simply file its quarterly financial reports without any advance expectation setting. In other words, Samuelson has located a specific behavior that's within the control of the executive. The expectations dance is the perfect symbol of short-term thinking. 2. Point to the destination. Samuelson should sell the vision here. How will life be different for the progressive CEO who rids himself of the burden of managing to the quarter rather than to the long term? What's the destination postcard? Motivate the elephant. Shrink the change. Note that by focusing on quarterly earnings guidance, Samuelson shrinks the change. It's an attainable first step on the road to long-term thinking. 2. Appeal to identity. Samuelson could play up the fact that the CEOs of some well-respected companies, GE, Microsoft, Coca-Cola, Google, and others, have already made this change. If other CEOs want to act like forward-thinking CEOs, this is the step they need to take. Shape the path. 1. Build a habit. Remember the story of Donald Berwick and the campaign to save 100,000 lives? Berwick made it easy for hospitals to join the campaign. They simply submitted the hospital CEO's signature on a one-page form. At that point, Berwick's team swooped in to help the hospital build the new habits. What if Samuelson could make it that easy to join a no-earnings guidance campaign? Her team should offer a simple checklist of things to address, including legal, PR, and operational issues, and support the companies as they change. 2. Rally the herd. Some CEOs are reluctant to discontinue earnings guidance. They worry that investors will think it's a signal that the company is in trouble and will hurry to sell off their stock. Samuelson could help CEOs counter this perception by organizing a drop the guidance day on a certain date. That way, the timing of the announcement would be less conspicuous. Also, by linking together business leaders who are intrigued by the idea, Samuelson could encourage a bandwagon effect. As we'll later see, behavior is contagious. 4. Destination postcards, pictures of a future that hard work can make possible, can be incredibly inspiring. The first graders dreamed of being third graders. Laura Esserman's team imagined a new kind of breast care clinic that would cater to the needs of the patient. But what if your team isn't inspired? What if, in fact, members of your team are secretly or not so secretly resistant to the vision of the future you've articulated? This introduces a new enemy. Rationalization. For instance, surely we've all made a New Year's resolution to be healthier. We conjure up a mental image of our future selves, fit and svelte, and we like what we see. But deep inside us, the commitment isn't there. A few days after January 1st, we get hungry and we see that gorgeous bag of Cheetos in the pantry. There's no question what the elephant wants. A big mouthful of Cheetoian goodness. And when the elephant wants something badly, the rider can be trusted to go along. What choice does he have? He may actually begin to formulate rationalizations to excuse the breach. Well, we did eat that salad last Thursday, and for Pete's sake, we bought 1% milk at the grocery store. We don't want to go overboard on this diet. A few Cheetos is a reasonable reward for good behavior. And presto! We eat the Cheetos. Even more impressive than that, we'll still be convinced in our heart of hearts that we're being healthier. A big-picture goal like be healthier is necessarily imprecise, and that ambiguity creates wiggle room for the elephant. It makes it easier to rationalize failure. One response to this dilemma is to set up super prescriptive goals. Your firm might announce, "We will boost revenue by 14.2% this year." Certainly, that's much better than just urging employees to do their best. But although numbers themselves are wiggle-proof, the way we deal with numbers isn't. For instance, if your firm achieved a 12.3% increase in revenue, do you really think anyone would get fired? Or is it more likely that a compelling rationalization would smooth over the discrepancy? "Team, in this economic climate, we should consider 12.3% a huge victory." The danger is present in our personal lives, too. Imagine that, in hopes of reining in your alcohol consumption, you set a goal of drinking no more than one glass of wine per night. Well, let's face it. There will come a night when your elephant is going to crave more than one, and that's when the boundaries are going to get fuzzy. You'll honor your one-glass rule by filling your glass all the way to the brim, or you'll mentally trade an extra drink now for a zero-drink night in the speculative future. We're all loophole-exploiting lawyers when it comes to our own self-control. If you're worried about the possibility of rationalization at home or at work, you need to squeeze out the ambiguity from your goal. You need a black-and-white B&W goal. A B&W goal is an all-or-nothing goal, and it's useful in times when you worry about backsliding. Maybe your B&W goal for your alcohol consumption could be no wine ever. No wiggle room there. And what if we changed our New Year's resolution from be healthier to gym every day, or even no more Cheetos? Those goals leave nowhere to hide. Either you've got damning orange Cheeto dust on your fingers or you don't. Note that B&W goals, no more Cheetos, no wine ever, are not inspiring at all. They're 100% restrictive. Furthermore, they are scripting critical behaviors rather than painting a picture of a destination. Is it possible to combine the emotional power of a destination postcard with the rationalization-squashing strength of a B&W goal? Yes. And to see how, consider the case of British Petroleum, BP. In 1991, BP announced a B&W goal that shocked its employees who had spent years in the oil industry. It was the multi-billion-dollar equivalent of no more Cheetos.